Good morning, this is AM, I'm Chris Yuleman. 30 nations, including China and Russia, have gathered in Paris for talks about the threat posed by the terrorist group Islamic State. The United States is trying to sign up more countries to its coalition of the willing to fight the militants in Syria and Iraq. Iran wasn't invited to the Paris conference, but the US has left the door open for future discussions, even though Iran's supreme leader has called America's actions absurd. North America correspondent Michael Vincent reports.
The United States' desire to degrade and destroy Islamic State has meant finding some odd allies, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. There cannot be double standards in the war against terrorism, he says. Terrorists can't be good or bad. We must be consistent and not involve our personal political projects, not prioritise them over the general goal of fighting terrorism. The Russians have ruled out joining any military coalition. The meeting of 30 nations, including the five permanent UN Security Council members, European and Arab states, all signed up to help the new government of Iraq fight Islamic State. Iran was not invited to these talks, but the United States is keen to keep them in the loop. It's quite a change for one of the axis of evil a dozen years ago. Iran's supreme leader is not showing any signs of warming to America. Really amusing is how he reportedly dubbed US pronouncements on Islamic State. He followed up by calling the statements absurd, hollow and biased, with dirty intentions and hands, and he questioned how Iran could participate under such conditions. But the US State Department is not ruling out discussions with Iran. Spokeswoman Marie Harf.
We are willing to sit down in a counterterrorism forum and discuss these issues with the Iranians. That this conference wasn't the right time. And again, the French were in charge of invitations. There will be plenty of conferences and discussions, and I'm sure when we're all in New York, there will be as well. So this is not the end-all be-all of conferences.
In the US Capitol, there's still debate about what support to give the US president. A vote may happen tomorrow. Some American politicians are still trying to up the ante on Arab nations to commit forces on the ground. Republican Senator Rand Paul.
I think the first 10,000 soldiers marching into battle need to be from Iraq, live in Iraq, and they need to be fighting for their homeland. The second 10,000 need to be from Saudi Arabia, because frankly, Saudi Arabia has been aiding and abetting this by really for decades funding radical Islam.
Given the diplomacy involving Iran and Russia, White House spokesman Josh Earnest has been asked if President Obama could meet with either of those leaders at the United Nations next week.
So what's more likely, a meeting with President Rouhani or a meeting with President Putin?
I welcome your interest in the president's schedule at the United Nations General Assembly. It will be...
Which would be more beneficial?
Well, I won't... I don't know that either of those individuals will appear on the president's dance card next week. So when we have the president's scheduled layout, we can discuss it.
The U.S. will host a debate at the U.N. Security Council on Islamic State this Friday. It's been described by the U.S. State Department as a mix of a discussion about Iraq and Syria, as well as coalition building for military action. This is Michael Vincent in Washington for AM.
The Prime Minister believes Islamic State militants can be destroyed by the US-led campaign against them, and he isn't bothered by the idea that the fight could see Australian forces kill fellow citizens in battle. But some in the opposition are uneasy about the rapid escalation of Australia's involvement, worried that it will become a protracted war. From Canberra, Alexandra Kirk reports.
Tony Abbott's move to counter criticism that the mission the government set in train for Australian forces lacks a clear stated goal. He says it's to work with Iraqi and Kurdish forces to ensure they can keep their people safe and to disrupt and degrade Islamic State operations inside Iraq.
And if it is possible to degrade them to the point of extinction, well, that obviously would be good. But our objective, fundamentally humanitarian, to disrupt and to degrade as far as we can.
Defence Minister David Johnston thinks the militant group can be destroyed.
I believe the end game is that we will disrupt and potentially destroy what is in the minds of the leadership of ISIL.
And the Prime Minister's warned Australian troops could be pitted against fellow citizens fighting with terrorist groups, particularly Islamic State, explaining that involvement was a key reason for committing Australia to the military campaign.
If they are killed in conflict, they know the risks, they took their chances, they broke Australian law, they are doing something which is a very serious offence under Australian law, and I say again, to any Australian who might be thinking of travelling to the Middle East to join in terrorist activity, don't. Don't. It is wrong. It is against God. It is against religion. It is against our common humanity.
While opposition leader Bill Shorten strongly backing the deployment, some of his left faction colleagues are uneasy, saying it could end up being a protracted war. They say war is a sensitive issue in the Labor movement. One MP says some in Labor's left have concerns and reservations, but aren't publicly criticising their party's position of being at one with the government, believing Labor has no other choice than to offer bipartisan support. Melissa Park is willing to express her concern. An aid worker and lawyer with the United Nations, before entering Parliament, she's made a brief statement explaining her position, saying she's horrified by the brutal killing of British aid worker David Haynes.
However, I am very concerned that the government has so quickly escalated Australia's involvement in Iraq from strictly humanitarian protection to now committing Australia to what appears to be an open-ended war that will only increase the security threat to Australians, a threat that is already heightened by our involvement in the 2003 Iraq debacle.
The Labor backbencher says she'll have more to say in a forthcoming speech to Parliament.
Alexandra Kirk reporting. Bill Shorten is the opposition leader and he's touring Tasmania at the moment. He joins me from Burnie. Welcome to AM.
Good morning, Chris.
Bill Shorten, is the Labor Party united in its support for the Abbott government's decision to send troops to Iraq?
The Labor Party that I lead is united in promoting national security. I sympathise with the anxiety which Melissa Park has expressed that matters are moving very quickly. And again, I express my horror too at the murder of aid workers who go to these countries to help people, not to be harmed themselves. But I do believe the Labor Party recognises that this is not the same as the 2003 Gulf War. And we have set clear parameters in terms of what we think Australia needs to be doing. But there's an important point here. Some people would say that if we did nothing, then these problems wouldn't be a problem for Australia. I don't accept that. The briefings, which I can't go into detail about, have convinced me that what happens in northern Iraq and Syria has repercussions for our safety in Australia.
But what happens in Syria has been happening for some time. 200,000 people have been killed there. Australians joined that fight a long time ago. So why join this fight now?
Well, I think you make a good point that the Syrian tragedy has been carried out for quite a period of time. There's a million refugees in Jordan. There's a million refugees in Lebanon. But what seems to, I think, have attracted world attention is that the world is not automatically on the side of the Syrian government, Assad. But when it comes to the undermining of the Iraqi national government, I think the world takes a different view. The Iraqi national government has reached out and become less sectarian. It has reached out to have a deputy prime minister who's Kurdish, a deputy prime minister who's Sunni. And the Iraqi government, through the Americans, have asked for our assistance. This is a material difference to 2003.
It's a legitimate concern, though, isn't it, that these things sometimes start small and end up being quite a bit larger? The experience going all the way back to Vietnam has shown that.
Oh, I think you're right. These matters have to be proceeded through very carefully, step by step. Labor has made it clear that whilst we do support what has been done so far and that we're all in this together when it comes to fighting terrorism, we've also made it clear that we don't want Australian combat troops and formed up units directly engaging in combat with IS. We want the operations of our military to be confined to the territory of Iraq, where that government has asked for our assistance. We think that the air offensive operations, and they haven't actually formally started, there's just been a pre-deployment request to the Middle East, to the UAE, should only continue as long as is necessary to place the Iraqi government and their forces in a position to be able to ensure the security
of their
country.
That's a fine judgment, though, isn't it? How would you know when that's the case?
Well, first of all, you've got to have principles by which guide your actions, and what I'm enunciating is Labor's principles. We also think that it is possible to work through objectives when you know when you should finish, and I think that is an important debate. And legitimately, some of the commentators and some people are expressing concern of a right to see what the objectives are, and Labor is up for working that through with the government.
Now, some of the same people in the left are concerned about your border protection policies. Is there any likelihood that you'll abandon your commitment to offshore processing?
No.
That's a firm roll goal commitment. You're not going to abandon it?
No.
Will it be changed in any way?
No, we support regional resettlement and we support the offshore processing. I think you raise an interesting question, though, in terms of refugees. When we talk about humanitarian, if I can combine the two topics, when we talk about humanitarian assistance in Iraq and Syria, perhaps, and I'll be having further discussions with my deputy leader, Tanya Plibersek, and others, perhaps it's time to discuss, do we take more refugees from these countries? I think that when we look at the fact that we're having military, potentially military operations, humanitarian relief comes in many forms, but not the least of which is support for refugees to come to Australia, especially if they can't live in their old towns and villages.
So you'd like to see an increase in the humanitarian intake again, up to 20,000, which is what it was under Labor before the change of government?
I won't give a final number until I've consulted my colleagues, but that's in the right direction.
Now, you're touring Tasmania at the moment talking about jobs. How can you help?
Well, first of all, people don't understand how knocked around parts of Tasmania are. Youth unemployment in northwestern Tasmania is nearly 20%. That's a lifetime of hopelessness. And the Abbott government really don't have a plan. So I think, for instance, we have to make sure that we're not cutting back on university and TAFE funding. We visited the Cradle Coast campus of University of Tasmania. And they've got a lot of people there who are mature age students. The increase in the HECS debt is discouraging people from doing studies. It's got existing students worried. There's a lot of women enrolled here. They worry about their ability to refinance university-related debt. How on earth can we help people get out of the cycle of unemployment if we make the walls they've got to climb of education so costly, so high that they can't even think about it?
But isn't a 20% unemployment rate in Burnie a legacy of 16 years of state Labor rule?
No, it's a consequence of changing economy. I'm visiting Queenstown today. The two mines there are closing. World metal prices are down, and so the cost of extracting the metal from underneath the ground has now been deemed to be too expensive. But in Queenstown, to lose 350 jobs is massive. I mean, I will say that the Queenstown Footy Club won the local footy competition here. That's a bit of good news, but really it's been some pretty bad news for Queenstown in recent weeks and months. Again, this is unemployment. The Abbott government hasn't got a plan for jobs in Australia or jobs in Tasmania. Tony Abbott famously said recently, well, for hundreds of years, people have been moving for jobs. So his advice to Tasmania is leave Tasmania. I don't know. That's just not a recipe for anything.
Look, one, the final brief question. Are you prepared to negotiate with the Coalition over the future of the renewable energy target?
We believe renewable energy and a renewable energy target should be bipartisan. But we're not prepared to go with silly options such as was proposed in the Warburton report. It's not a negotiation to either get rid of renewable energy targets or to make renewable energy targets so low as that they're meaningless. We do believe in bipartisanship. I cannot believe this government's got away with undermining billions of dollars of investment and uncertainty over thousands of jobs. It's just vandalism.
Bill Shorten, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you.
Thank you.
And that is the opposition leader, Bill Shorten, speaking to me from Burnie. You're listening to AM Around Australia, where it's 24 minutes past 7. The European Union's climate chief says she's surprised Australia's Prime Minister won't attend a major United Nations climate summit next week. More than 120 world leaders will gather in New York to tackle what the UN Secretary-General says is one of the defining issues of our time. Ban Ki-moon is hoping for bold pledges to cut emissions. The US President is expected to attend, but Tony Abbott isn't, even though he'll be in New York for another UN meeting just a day later. The ABC's environment reporter Jake Sturmer has the story.
The US President and the UK Prime Minister are among the 125 global heavyweights who'll be at the meeting next week to lay the groundwork for a global climate change agreement. Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott will be in New York next week too, but he'll arrive one day after those other world leaders. He's going for a Security Council meeting about foreign terrorist fighters.
Well, what a coincidence, isn't it?
The EU's Climate Commissioner is Connie Hedegaard.
It's, of course, a pity that not everyone is going, but what I'm looking into is that, as far as I understand, there are now more than 125 confirmed heads of state. So I think that at least 125 heads of state have sent a strong signal to the rest of the world.
Do you feel the Australian Prime Minister is out of step with the rest of the world by not attending this summit?
That is for Australia and the Australian citizens to judge. What does it mean? I do not know what the reasons would be behind it. But of course, the world will interpret who is showing up and who will not be showing up. So that's for your Prime Minister and your government to decide what kind of profile they want to have in this.
Major polluters China and India aren't sending their presidents or prime ministers either. Australia will be represented by the Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop.
I believe that more and more heads of state around the planet realise that although a lot of good things are going on, the sad fact is that climate change is worsening almost by the day.
The nation of Kiribati is the canary in the coal mine when it comes to climate change. It's about 7,000 kilometres northeast of Australia and is already feeling the devastating impacts of rising tides. The president of the small Pacific Island nation is Anatay Tong.
It's really a matter of survival. You know, the projections of sea level rise is between half a metre to 1 metre. That's serious for us. We would not survive. If we don't do anything, we would not survive.
President Tong will get his chance to speak on the world stage at the UN next week. The test will be who listens.
Environment reporter Jake Sturmer. The Indigenous Affairs Minister Nigel Scullion plans to revive his controversial proposal to strip Northern Territory Land Councils of some of their powers over traditional owners. The minister tried to push the changes through Parliament earlier this year, backed by a clan in Arnhem Land, but the attempt failed. Now the balance of power in the Senate has changed and the minister has vowed to try again. Anna Henderson filed this report from Arnhem Land.
While the Prime Minister is holding public events in Arnhem Land, there are also talks behind the scenes, away from the media spotlight. The Northern Land Council plans to travel to Arnhem Land today with the hopes of securing a meeting. The Land Council has statutory obligations to assist Aboriginal people in the Top End, to manage their traditional lands and seas. But the Indigenous Affairs Minister, Nigel Scullion, has been championing a new approach, transferring some functions from the Land Councils to local Indigenous corporations. Senator Scullion put a regulation to the Parliament earlier this year in the previous upper house. Labor and the Greens used their majority to block the changes. Senator Scullion maintains he will try again.
I'll be just introducing a regulation again, exactly the same regulation that asks that land councils simply respond to their constituents within 3 months.
He expects that will be a matter of months away.
But that's obviously on my agenda, but it won't be until towards the end of the year until that's introduced.
The Northern Land Council is worried the regulation could transfer the powers to grant township leases and consent to mining exploration.
We haven't seen the details about what is being proposed this time and if it is in fact different from the previous attempt.
The Land Council's Chief Executive Joe Morrison says he has deep reservations about the government's position.
The previous attempt created all sorts of liabilities potentially for the Northern Land Council, providing statutory responsibilities to a corporation is just absurd, and no government would provide their statutory responsibilities to a corporation. They're two different and exclusive matters to be dealt with.
Given the makeup of the Senate, it's likely the government will end up negotiating with the crossbench, in particular the Palmer United Party. There are signs the PUP won't support the federal government. The party recruited Northern Territory politician Alison Anderson earlier this year. In a recent opinion piece, she described the minister as a wolf in sheep's clothing, pushing the regulation for the federal government's own political benefit. But the Ruachingu Aboriginal Corporation in Arnhem Land backs the minister's efforts, describing them as a chance for traditional owners to take control over development, business and employment opportunities on their land.
Anna Henderson reporting. On the financial markets in New York, the Dow Jones has closed at 17,031 points. That's up 44 points. The Nasdaq has closed at 4,519, down 49 points. In London, the FT 100 has closed at 6,804. That's down 3 points. The dollar is buying 90.34 US cents, up 0.18 on yesterday's close, and it's buying 96.83 Japanese yen and 69.82 euro cents. I'm Chris Yulman. That's AM for today.